From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, as the U.S. builds its naval capability in the region, the WHO works to ease suffering in Yemen.
Hospitals are overwhelmed with casualties. There is a need for additional medical and surgical staff, doctors.
A German program to help migrants overcome traumatic experiences at sea. And the Japanese Prime Minister is coming to Washington. It's all ahead for you. I'm Susan Yaki. The United States has bolstered its naval presence in the Arabian Sea by deploying the aircraft carrier Theodore Roosevelt and the guided missile cruiser Normandy to seven other U.S. warships as an Iranian convoy suspected of carrying arms for Shiite Houthi rebels steams toward Yemen. U.S. Central Command says the American warships will conduct maritime security operations to keep vital sea lanes open and is the direct result of instability in Yemen. Sunday, Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, wrote in the New York Times, it is time for a regional dialogue to ease tensions in the Persian Gulf region. Monday, White House spokesman Josh Earnest was asked to respond.
One of the concerns that we have with Iranian behavior in terms of the destabilizing impact they're having on the broader region is the fact that they continue to supply weapons and offer support to the Houthis in Yemen. What the United States and the broader international community has called for is an end to the violence in Yemen, with the hopes, again, that the UN and a GCC-led process can try to reconcile the rather dramatic political differences that exist in that country. And so it's a little ironic for the Iranian foreign minister to be calling for a diplomatic resolution to that situation while at the same time his country continues to supply arms to one party to that dispute so that the violence can continue and in some cases even worsen. So we're hopeful that the international community will unite behind the UN-led effort to try to resolve the political crisis in that country.
At the same time, Earnest denounced reported espionage and other security-related charges against detained U.S. journalist Jason Rezaian by Iran as absurd, demanding they be dismissed and the dual U.S.-Iranian citizen be freed. Ben Connable, a Middle East analyst with the RAND Corporation, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, despite White House concerns, Iran is supplying Yemeni rebel weapons. He does not believe U.S. warships will attempt to turn back the Iranian convoy.
I would be very surprised if there were any plans to intercept Iranian vessels with the nuclear negotiations in the stage that they're in right now. I think this is just a measure to give the president more options in case things go south. I think the U.S. was caught off guard by the speed with which things collapsed in Yemen, and this is reaction.
What do you expect their mission will be? Just exercises, or as they indicate, just keeping the vital sea lanes there open?
Obviously, keeping the vital sea lanes open means more than just steaming around in squares. They'll probably be conducting a lot of reconnaissance flights from the Roosevelt and using their radars and other electronic collection apparatuses to kind of figure out what's going on in that area, and to add to the intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance capabilities in the region.
There are nine ships now in that region. Do you think that's sending a message? There are reports Iranian vessels are carrying weapons to the Houthi rebels.
I don't know if it's intended to send a message or simply to ensure that the United States maintains some influence and control in that area. It's always been a vital sea lane for the United States. There's a long history of the United States deploying naval assets into that area. So this is not actually all that unusual.
What happens if Yemen falls to the Houthis?
A significant portion of Yemen has already fallen to the Houthis, and another portion of it has fallen to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So the chaos we're seeing now is the result. I think what you would wind up seeing, though, is more fighting between the Sunni and Shia factions, and then also with the former regime coming in there as well. So it's a three-way fight right now, four-way if you include the Saudi coalition bombing by air. It is almost total chaos. I don't see how this is going to play out in a way that's positive either for the Yemenis or for the United States.
Iran, of course, is of the Shia brand of Islam, whereas some of these other elements are Sunni. So are they going to fight among themselves for control of Yemen? And is that good or bad news for the U.S. and the West?
I think instability is probably always bad news for the West. I'm not sure that it ever plays in America's favor. I think that the Iranians may have overextended themselves in Yemen. I'm not sure that this was all that well planned on their part. The Houthi have gone far out of their comfort zone by going all the way down to the coast. So while they may have had some dramatic strategic success now, that may not last. And because they've extended themselves into what are traditionally not Shia sectarian areas, you may see that inflamed sectarian fighting. You know, I think you're already seeing it. So the question is, you know, is this a sign or is it not a sign of a greater Sunni-Shia split across the Middle East? Is this part of the, you know, a broader tapestry of Sunni-Shia infighting? And, you know, some people interpret things that way and others see this more as a regional issue that's being exploited along sectarian lines.
Conable says neither the Iranian involvement in Yemen nor its detention of the American reporter appear to have upset the nuclear negotiations between Iran and six world powers, including the United States. The World Health Organization says it has delivered to Yemen more than 17 tons of medicines and medical supplies for more than 41,000 people. We discussed the situation in the war-torn nation with WHO spokesperson Rana Sadani, headquartered in Cairo, Egypt.
The humanitarian situation is really critical. The most important thing is the management of casualties and injuries. This remains the most pressing need, especially in the south. Hospitals are overwhelmed with casualties. There is a need for additional medical and surgical staff, doctors. In addition, health facilities are reporting critical shortages of life-saving medicines, trauma care, surgical and medical supplies in order to cope with the influx of injuries.
Do you have any numbers on how many people there are that need help?
Numbers of injured and dead people can vary because not all injured people are reporting to hospitals. Some of the communities prefer to treat their injured at home, so if there is a case of death, they bury their dead without reporting it as well. But the latest information we have shows that we have more than 736 deaths and more than 2,720 people injured. But these numbers are can give you an idea about death and injuries, but are not 100% accurate because there are some communities that don't report death and injuries to hospitals.
And I understand that 100,000 people may have been displaced since March by this fighting. Are you doing anything for those displaced people?
We are working with the ministries of health in order first to respond to their health needs. What's critical for us is that among the displaced communities, communicable diseases are prevented. That's why we have more than 65 people working in the field in order to monitor the health situation. They ask about their most recent diseases among this kind of communities in order to make sure that there are no communicable diseases. But the situation is really critical. The problem is not only the availability of health staff and medicines and medical supplies. The problem is access. Why? Because you have the medication, but because of insecurity, because of many checkpoints, you cannot sometimes deliver the life-saving medicine to health facilities. In order to find solution, WHO is working with the Ministry of Health, with many partners, to find access. If not by road, by sea. Recently, we sent a boat from Aden to Al-Mukalla in order to deliver medicines and to evacuate injured. So the most important thing really is access for the patient to be able to be treated if they are injured, if they are sick, access as well for mothers who are pregnant, for people who have chronic diseases such as asthma or any kind of chronic diseases, because those people are suffering as well, in particular because they need their medication no matter what, if there is a war if the war has ended.
How well is the World Health Organization holding up to all this strain and stress on the organization?
It's definitely a complicated situation because you know the need. Because of access, you cannot arrive anywhere. You try to find alternatives. We are lucky because we work with many partners, including NGOs or UN partners or the Ministry of Health, in order to strengthen the health partners inside the country. So we are able to send supplies to partners who have access in this area, or we can send supplies from outside the country. Recently, we delivered 17 tons of life-saving medicines from Dubai to Yemen. Those 7 tons of medical supplies and medicine are enough to treat 40,000 people. But Again, I repeat, the most urgent thing is really access, because you have the needs, you have the supplies, but in most of the cases, sometimes you are not able to deliver these supplies to the remote areas because of insecurities and many checkpoints.
Rana Sadani, Senior Communications Officer for the WHO Regional Office in Cairo, Egypt. Renewed outbreaks of violence have been reported in recent days in and around the Libyan capital, Tripoli. Violence comes as rival sides are attending United Nations-sponsored talks in Morocco on forming a national unity government. The UN Security Council last week urged the warring parties to settle their differences and bring an end to what was described as a political, security, and institutional crisis. The head of the UN mission in Libya, Bernardo Leon, has condemned the violence in Tripoli and called on all parties to create what he called a more conducive environment for the Morocco talks. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy spoke with former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State David Mack.
Would Libya's rival parties be ready to reach a consensus in the United Nations brokered talks in Morocco?
Well, I hope that they are. Certainly, the Libyan people are ready to see a consensus on a national unity government. There is really diminishing support for parliaments which insist that they monopolize all of the political legitimacy in the country. The parliaments themselves have to understand that the popular support for some of the positions they've been taking has been eroding rather rapidly. And the United Nations provides the ideal forum for negotiated, agreed upon arrangements to form this national unity government. And that is the way ahead that is supported by the U.S. government, other governments which have the best interests of the Libyan people at heart.
The Security Council also warned it was prepared to sanction those who threaten Libya's peace, stability, or security, or that obstruct or undermine the successful completion of its political transition. Would that entice reluctant parties to compromise?
It's not at all clear that sanctions are the best way to move ahead. To a certain extent, sanctions are most useful when they serve, when the possibility of sanctions serves as a motivation to parties to discard old, outdated positions and come to an agreement. On the other hand, it is true that there's a great deal of respect for the United Nations on the part of serious Libyans who know their own country's history. The United Nations was involved in helping Libya achieve its independence, and it can now help Libya return to unity and the kind of stability that will enable it to achieve its economic future, which is, frankly, very good, provided that they don't continue this downward spiral into the kind of disastrous situation which will make it impossible for Libya ever to play the kind of role that it could play in the prosperity of the region, and instead it will continue to be a factor of serious instability and basically remove any semblance of normal life from the future of the Libyan people.
As the United Nations peace talks are starting in Morocco, forces loyal to Libya's internationally recognized government carried out airstrikes near the capital, Tripoli, which is controlled by its rivals. How would that impact the talks when the United Nations Security Council stressed that there is no military solution in Libya?
Well, of course, it depends a little bit on what the targets of the strikes were, and that's a matter of dispute. I myself do not know. I don't think that there's any objective confirmation of what the targets would be, but certainly the general principle that there's no military solution to the current internal conflict is a correct one.
Final question. What would it take to secure a successful end to the UN-sponsored talks to end the Libyan crisis?
Well, the Libyan leaders who have a stake in this and are involved in guiding the two sides, and I use that term advisedly because these are basically both of them very rough coalitions with diverse factions, diverse interests, and diverse opinions on how to proceed. But basically, the leaders who are going to be meeting in these UN talks are going to have to realize what is increasingly obvious to not only to external friends of Libya, but to Libyans themselves, which is that their situation is becoming increasingly dire, both economically and in security terms. And it is possible to have some kind of compromise agreement that will serve the interests of all Libyans and will frankly serve the interests of all but the most extremist leaders on both sides who are going to need to be excluded from Libya's future government.
Former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State David Mack. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is participating this week in an Asia-Africa summit, and next week will make a state visit to the United States. The U.S. stop includes meetings with President Obama and an address to a joint meeting of Congress. We asked Michael Kuchek, adjunct fellow at Tokyo's Temple University, what message Mr. Abe will be bringing to Washington.
He'll be very careful to appeal to the United States, particularly in regards to the construction of a Futenma replacement facility in the Bay of Henoko. That has been a very difficult and long-term process that Japan has been interested in for a very, very long time, and the United States has had as a primary goal in the Japan-U.S. relationship. He'll have nice things to say about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, even though this morning at 4 a.m. when talks broke off, nothing still had been decided. More progress had been made, but the Trans-Pacific Partnership is still not yet ready to be unveiled. And finally, in terms of the Japan-U.S. military alliance, he has a large number of promises regarding increasing Japan's ability to participate in collective self-defense, which is when the United States is attacked, Japan will come to its aid under certain very limited circumstances. However, the legislation needed to realize that has not been passed yet. So Mr. Abe is actually premature in his address to Congress. So he comes with a lot of promises on his lips, but his hands are pretty much empty. But they're nice promises, and they're ones that the United States has wanted to hear for a very long time.
Michael Kuchek with Tokyo's Temple University. The European Union, following the several recent deadly maritime accidents in the Mediterranean, has come under mounting criticism for failing to develop an adequate response to the crisis. Last year, it scrapped a Mediterranean search and rescue program over concerns that the maritime operations were, in fact, encouraging more migrants from Africa and beyond to make the perilous voyage to Europe. People fleeing poverty and violence in parts of Africa, the Middle East, and Asia risk life and limb to reach safety in Europe. After a long and exhausting journey to reach the smugglers on the Mediterranean seacoast, there is the dangerous voyage across the sea in small and overcrowded vessels. More than 1,000 people have died so far this year during the arduous trek, either from exhaustion or by drowning after their boat sank. Those who have made it to European shores are sometimes traumatized by the experience. A program in Germany helps survivors overcome the trauma by giving a new perspective to their catastrophic experience. Zlatica Hoke has this report for VOA Television.
The Kukula Initiative in Berlin gives refugees and asylum seekers the opportunity to build furniture from planks of wood dismantled from the boats on which they escaped. The program has given new hope and confidence to a group of young immigrants who fled their homes in Africa and arrived in Germany after crossing the Mediterranean Sea from Libya to the Italian island of Lampedusa. One of them is this 23-year-old man from Mali.
I cannot forget the boats because I lost four friends in the waters. They could not swim, neither can I. I could not help them.
But making a useful object from the remnants of the boat from which he was picked up and taken first to Italy and then to Germany eases the pain of that memory, he says.
I think it helped me a lot. I can make a chair from those small pieces of wood. That is our story.
An immigrant from Nigeria, still speaking Italian, expresses a similar sentiment.
Sento bene.
I feel good because this is also my story and I will never forget it. I too will die, but I will have left my story behind.
And another one from Niger.
This is my Geschichte von Lampedusa.
This is my story of Lampedusa.
It comes from my heart, and I can't forget it. I would like other people to be able to tell their story.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel was one of the European Union leaders who spoke Thursday of the critical need to stop the smugglers from turning the Mediterranean Sea into what some people call a graveyard of the world's desperate.
Firstly, we must and will do everything to take up and continue the fight against traffickers who expose people to danger and death in an inhumane manner. Secondly, we will need to focus on overcoming the causes of people fleeing. And thirdly, and this is the most important issue these days, and I think all of us are moved by this, we will do everything to avoid victims continuing to die in the Mediterranean Sea on our doorstep in the most agonizing manner.
Humanitarian groups say more needs to be done for migrants who survived the journey.
The situation cannot be solved solely through politics. We need to adapt a social response too, through new ideas and a willingness to live together.
The Kukula Initiative has raised about $130,000 for this furniture project. To support the cause, organizers are selling 100 of the chairs called Bambino, which can be ordered in small or large sizes, costing between $140 and $270. The goal is to help immigrants develop skills aimed at rebuilding the self-confidence that many have lost while seeking asylum. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Once the fighting ends and soldiers lay down their arms, the difficult work of negotiating peace and preparation for post-conflict recovery begins. At this point, leaders have an opportunity to reshape their country's politics and socioeconomic landscape. And it is imperative that women be offered a seat at the negotiating table. That's because, in the words of Assistant Secretary for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor Tom Malinowski, women are critical to the reconciliation process since you cannot build peace with only half a nation's voices at the table. Women and girls have a unique perspective on the causes of conflict and its effects on the population. Civilians suffer disproportionate amounts of abuse in wartime, and too often women and girls are specifically targeted for exploitation and violence, particularly sexual violence, by both sides. They suffer material hardship, are frequently displaced by the conflict, yet must still perform day-to-day chores to keep the family and community alive. They understand obstacles to peace and survival on the local level and know what needs to be done to fix the problems. Nonetheless, they are often underrepresented or even denied any role in efforts to resolve hostilities and address their root causes. They get no say on how to rebuild society in a manner that promotes peaceful resolution to conflicts. Their most pressing concerns, such as violence against women or holding perpetrators accountable for past abuses, are too often given short shrift. But these are problems that affect the civilian population as a whole. If they are not resolved as part of the peace process and grievances are allowed to fester, they often make post-conflict recovery difficult. Women's perspectives enlarge the scope of conversations about peace and reconciliation. They draw attention to critical priorities that might otherwise be overlooked, said Assistant Secretary Malinowski. Supporting women to play a role in peace building is not a new concept. It's an idea that the United States has emphasized for over a decade now at the United Nations. It's an idea that women and men around the world have embraced as a cornerstone of peace and prosperity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.